This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā, tēnā koutou katoa, no mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. I'm your host, Sally Carlton, and today we're going to be talking about bilingualism and I guess also multilingualism in a single language dominant society, in this case particularly New Zealand. We've got four guests in the studio. Anna Filipčikina.
Filipčikina.
Perfect, thank you. Jawada Freire, Una Cunningham and Jen Kim. Now, if you could all introduce yourselves, please, tell us a little bit about yourself and what's your background in relation to languages. Jawad, how about we start with you?
Okay. I'm an engineer, but who happened to teach Farsi language to African kids in Hagley College, and that's how I came across to multilingualism, mingling with African kids, mainly African kids, with some other Farsi speakers. That's me.
How long have you been in New Zealand?
I moved in here in 2008, so it's like 9 years now. And yeah.
And how long have you been involved with the Farsi school?
About since 2010, so 6 or 7 years.
Fantastic. Yeah. I'm sure we'll learn a lot more about it. And, yeah, and the lovely kids that you teach, they are so cute.
Thank you very much.
Anna?
I'm involved in languages because language is my job, actually. I have a degree, a master degree in teaching Russian language and literature. And when I came to New Zealand in 1998, I can't believe, I couldn't speak English. That's why I started to teach Russian. And in 2000, we established our Russian Cultural Center and Russian School. And since that time, I'm teaching Russian language.
And you're also involved in CLANS.
Yes, CLANS. It's a, I think it's a very important part of our, how to say, very important part of my activities, let's say. In 2007, I decided to make a little research how many community schools we have in Christchurch. And together with the City Council, with other organizations, we started to do the professional development of community language teachers program. It was an amazing experience, and all principals of the community schools came together. We met each other for the first time, and we share our experience, which is very, very important. Since that time, I started to contact with CLANS, Community Languages Association of New Zealand, and we had made a number of programs. And the last year, I think it was a very successful year, because we, after the earthquake, we decided to continue this program, which is very successful. And thanks to the university, to other our supporters, City Council, we succeed, and we had three very, very successful seminars for community language teachers, which is share, give us the opportunity to share our experience, our knowledge, and just we are crazy people who wants to contribute something to the society. And we believe we are living in a, it's the 21st century, impossible to live in a monolingual country.
And I'm sure we'll learn a lot more about that as we go through. Jin.
Kia ora, 안녕하세요. I'm Jin. I'm originally from Korea, and I have lived here in New Zealand for over 14 years. I'm a PhD candidate at University of Canterbury with a focus on heritage language maintenance and transmission, and I'm working with Una as my supervisor and Professor Jeanette King.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And you're also involved in Korean language school, are you?
I used to, not anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you're raising two young kids, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, yes. They were born in Korea but raised here in New Zealand and in the UK for a while. Yeah.
So it'll be interesting having your perspective as a parent, I think.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, hello. I'm Una Cunningham. I'm a specialist in learning and teaching languages at the University of Canterbury. And I have raised four children with two languages myself in Sweden. Swedish and English, and I research heritage language transmission. We have a journal of home language research and a number of doctoral students who are working in the field, including Jin here.
Both Jin and Una, you mentioned the term heritage language. I'd be interested to maybe tease out that a wee bit. Is it the same, for example, as community language, which is what CLANS uses? Also, perhaps minority language. What are the difference between these various terms?
There's a lot of overlap between the meanings, really. But there are some areas at the edges where they're used a bit differently. So I think generally when Anna talks about community languages, it's something you could also call heritage language, or often perhaps even home language as well. But a home language needs to be spoken in the home. And a community language doesn't necessarily need to be spoken in the home. You can imagine a situation where the parents don't speak the language in the home, but the child anyway learns the language in the community school. And heritage language is sometimes referring to a situation where the language belongs to the family, but hasn't been spoken for a number of generations. That's often the way it's used in, for example, the United States, where you'll have people who talk about their Russian as a heritage language. Maybe Russian hasn't been spoken for two or three generations. So it's quite variable.
Another terminology question that I have is, if we're talking about people speaking multiple languages, first language, second language, mother tongue, native language, and the sort of the terminology around those different categories.
Well, to be honest, I have to add after introduction to the guests, I have to go back to school probably to do some studies in education and learning languages and teaching languages. I'm not a professional teacher, but from a normal person from public and an immigrant as well, to me, putting heritage language aside, I always had a perception that heritage language is a language not necessarily from a family, but for example, coming from Afghanistan, there are some remote villages in Afghanistan people speak a language that no one probably have heard of it before, and it's a very small communities that may speak that language. And I always thought that because this is kind of a remaining language from probably ancient time, that probably no one has paid attention to that. I thought that's the heritage language, and for us, mother language is what we learned there. And when we came here as a community language, then because we Afghans speak a version of Persian that is different from Persian spoken in Iran and Persian spoken in Tajikistan, when we gather here in New Zealand as foreigners, we probably have some communities which have interconnection, then we share through English, although our language is slightly different, but it has the same basis, combine it with some flavor of English that becomes community language, and we all understand each other talking in Persian. And we've got native language that, to me, I thought that, talking to Phil in New Zealand, many people coming, migrating. There has been some native people like Maori people here. Te Reo becomes their that becomes the native language of the country, and then the rest of the people are speaking their community languages. So this was my perception, but I would be really keen to hear from professionals that they are not distinctly, they can be different and they can overlap, but the terminology can be quite complicated sometimes, I guess.
Definitely so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think native, really, a native language, it refers to a language you're born with. That's the native part.
Yeah.
So that's not necessarily, people can have more than one native language.
Mm.
They can have more than one first language. So that my children growing up in Sweden, for example, had both Swedish and English as their first language.
Yeah.
And then they... other children, perhaps, who grew up in a family where both parents speak Farsi,
yeah,
would be perhaps have Farsi as their first language.
Yes,
and later they would learn English, come in contact with English as they go out into early childhood education and school, and that would be their second language. And they might actually not develop native-like skills in Farsi if later on they don't get a good chance to practice it as their language develops. But they might well develop native-like skills in English. They probably will if they live in New Zealand.
Yeah. So it's possible to have two first languages.
Yes.
Because I always, again, coming from public, talking to children in our school, their first language is English, no matter how much their parents talk in Farsi in at home. But the way they think, they structure the sentence, and even the whole ideology of talking and communicating, it's English that it drives that conversation. Although they may speak in Farsi with us, but at the back of their mind, they're talking to English, and some part of their mind, they're translating into Farsi, and we can really feel that. And so to me, I thought that the environment can have that much effect that... you can have only one language as your first language, but it's very interesting to know that you can basically
have two languages. Depends what you put into the word first. If you mean first as in the strongest, or if you mean first as the one that came before the others. And linguists usually mean the one that came before the others as your first language.
Yeah.
So your second language can later become your strongest language, but not your first language.
Yes.
And your second language can be the one you're a native speaker of, and not your first language, even though that it's kind of messy. With migrants, it just gets messy.
Yes, yes.
I think this is probably something we'll be exploring a lot. How do multiple layers, I suppose, of language come on top of each other, particularly when you've migrated, particularly as you're growing up in New Zealand? I just guess what I want to clarify before we go any further in this conversation is that when we're speaking community or heritage languages, in New Zealand, we're not referring to Te Reo or New Zealand Sign Language. Is that the case?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think we'll do another show where we look specifically at those two, but this is looking at other languages.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be time then for our first break. And Jawad, you chose a song, which is actually quite perfect given what you've been talking about, called Persian Is Our Heart.
Yes.
Any particular reason for that?
Oh, well, first time I heard this song was... probably 3-4 years ago. So the poet has died maybe, 15 years ago. I got the invite to come to this program. Just at the back of my mind said, I have heard a song about the Persian language. And I chose this song because the poet was an Afghan. The singer is Iranian, and the guys who are playing the instruments are from Tajikistan. So they're showing the common theme at the back that, we are all speaking the same language, and it's the thing that is kind of a glue stitching these three countries together as people who speak the same language with different dialects.
Beautiful. Well, here it is then. Persian Is Our Heart.
Thank you. غزل پارسی شکر شکر به سمرقند قند و عسل پارسی گل نیست ماه نیست دل ماست پارسی غوغای کوه ترنم دریا پارسی گل نیست ماه نیست دل ماست پارسی غوغای کوه ترنم دریا پارسی
Back to Speak Up Kōrerotia with Sally Carlton, your host. We've got Anna, Jawad, Jin and Una, and we're discussing bi- and multilingualism in New Zealand. I thought we might kick this section off by thinking about what are some of the benefits, the advantages of being able to speak multiple languages, particularly in a society that's predominantly monolingual. Open the floor to whoever would like to jump in.
I would like to share actually findings from my study.
Perfect.
Because I carried out interviews with New Zealand-born Korean immigrant children as well as their parents about what is the advantages they feel being as a bilingual speakers for both Korean and English. They said, particularly children said, they have more advantages for their academic and career pathways because parents might be concerned that if they are focusing on speaking their heritage language, which is Korean for this context, their English language acquisition might negatively affect on their academic skills. But it turned out the other way. So these Korean immigrant children, they have really good grades, marks on their NCL levels, and they haven't had any language difficulties, especially English language. So it went really well. So I would recommend they should focus on speaking their heritage language at home.
So your advice is if the Korean, for example, is the children's first or native language, speaking it in the home is not detrimental to their English language acquisition.
That's right.
Yeah, fantastic.
I think when a person can speak two languages or more, he's becoming another person. It's a way, again, a way of the way that we think when we communicate can be quite different in each language. And when I look at people who are able to speak more than one language, I think they have two ways of approaching tackling the problem or communicating with one person. And it's how the brain works and how powerful it is that has that much capacity that no matter you're knowing one language or two, still functioning at the same level. So it's just a reserve capacity in the brain that most of the migrant children are using that part of the brain, but probably monolingual students are not using that part of the brain and it's just not functioning. And I guess that's why I've read in the papers that bilingual people have less chance of getting dementia when they are older, and that's because they are using that part of the brain. It's like muscles. If you use muscles, work out, you're healthy. If don't, you will be weak very soon. So I think totally makes sense to speak more than one language. Yeah,
I think there are other cognitive and developmental benefits as well.
Absolutely. I think the language impossible to learn without understanding of even or trying to understand the culture, different culture. And because we are sitting here, I don't know about you, but all of us, we are migrants.
Oh, yeah, me too, actually.
You too. Congratulations. So, and everybody who is coming to a new country experiences the cultural shock. So how we can learn another language? It's something different from our culture, our background. And doing this effort to learn another language, I think we can understand other people better, because how difficult it is to learn another language, but also to accept others, because we can understand them better. I have in front of me the Star newspaper, and probably you've seen our changing face of Christchurch. You see, this is the future of Christchurch. And New Zealand, actually, it's a country of migrants. It's always will be, and understand each other and respect each other. It's a very healthy thing. And without learning language, no matter how fast we can learn the language, how fluent we are, at least we're trying to understand other person. And this is very important.
Yeah, well, we talk about languages being so crucial to identity, don't we? So taking that step further and being able to understand others' identities as well.
When we come into a new country, I couldn't bring with me anything. And only important things I brought with me, it's the language. And so this is up to society, I think, and to family, first of all, to decide, do we going to continue to keep our heritage, language, important things from our country, our culture, or we have to learn English and that's it, and integrate to new life.
I think there's a difference really between the migrant who comes here and needs to think about keeping their language skills going and passing their language on to their children. Because for the next generation, having access to the heritage language, to their parents' language or parent language, is hugely valuable. It's valuable on the individual level, just as you say, Sally, that there are these cognitive benefits. But it's also valuable on the relationship level and on the level of identity. And Jin's research has shown that people do suffer if they don't grow up with competence in their parents' language. It's also valuable on the level of the family, so that the extended family, the grandparents back in the old country, can speak to the little children here. Otherwise, the family really falls apart. And the people back home feel that the next generation are totally lost to them. And for the young person growing up here, it means also that they don't have access to go back to their parents' home. And, well, they might visit, but they can't just slip in and be part of that society in a way that they could if they had access to the language and culture. But it's also important as something for New Zealand. New Zealand needs multilingual people, because the world is multilingual. So the transnational families who are in New Zealand are a huge asset for the country.
Because of this reason, Ministry of Education promoted internationalization capability in 2014. That means the Ministry of Education promotes especially secondary school children to learn more of another foreign language to become a global citizen, and that may enhance their cultural awareness, as well as this may bring a benefit to society. So it's working that way.
So I guess one of the questions then is, you've mentioned the Ministry of Education is getting on board. Have any of you in your professional or personal capacities come across much resistance to promoting the idea of bio-multiculturalism?
Working in an engineering consultancy, I think with the globalization and internationalization of even the companies around the world, I think even now companies think as an opportunity for to reach, to provide services to countries, other countries, and they see this as an opportunity to employ people who speak that country, foreign language, and they know the culture. And this is kind of a, they also showcase it as they, we've have this bright people from your country who speak your language. And so they're trying to compete in this world to get jobs overseas. So I think from professional side of the work, yeah, I think at least in New Zealand they embrace bilingualism and they encourage it.
Mm.
Yeah,
we do a lot of outreach work through the Better Start project, which is led by Professor Gail Gillan and Professor Angus McFarlane at the University of Canterbury, as well as other universities. We actually visit early childhood education centres and talk to them about ways they can enhance the linguistic landscape, the visible writing on the wall, to encourage and welcome and value the languages that the families of the children have with them. And what we see there is that the early childhood educators are very interested in how they can support the children, want to know lots of things, and they do have a lot of questions from the parents. For example, will it hurt my child if I speak my language? And of course, we're able to give them the answer, no, it won't. Do speak your language. That's the greatest gift you can give your child. So people are concerned, but well, welcoming of information. There isn't a lot of public information available.
Which might be a good point to do a little plug for your website and blog, actually, because I had a look and there's fantastic information on there.
Thank you. Yes, we have a website called Growing Up with Two Languages, which is available at twolanguages.canterbury.ac.nz. And that's two languages written as a word. And we also have a Facebook page, Growing Up with Two Languages. So welcome everybody to like that page. And we give all the information there about the public lectures and workshops that we hold.
Ona, you mentioned that encouraging children to speak their first language doesn't harm their English. Is there any evidence that it can actually help develop English language competency as well?
Really, growing up in New Zealand, you don't need to be worried about children's English. We had one student who had a baby who was the mother was speaking French to the baby, and she said, if my child grows up monolingual, it's not going to be in French. The children get swamped with English. There's English all around them. They hear English all day. They're using English all day. They're developing English in the schools. The teachers are excellent at meeting the needs of these children. Growing up with more than one language does make a child more aware of language, makes them more understanding that things can have more than one name. And that's a nice advantage. It's a kind of a cognitive maturity that these children get at an earlier age than other children. But they don't need help with their English. Their English will be just fine.
That's more or less what I thought.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And some of my child participants said, when I carried out interviews with them, they said because they have ability to speak another language apart from speaking English here, that when they learn another language or including, you know, English language acquisition, they think more carefully about the structure of the language. So that may help them to learn carefully about English. Yeah, that was what they said.
Fantastic. Well, it's almost time for another song. And Jin, we've got your choice, which Pōkarikari Ana, a Māori folk song. I'm particularly interested to hear the story behind your choice, actually.
Yes. I believed this song is a Korean folk song before I came to New Zealand because the lyrics are exactly the same. So that Māori song translate into English, no, Korean, into Korean. And we believe that passed on through the Korean War, that was like the Second World War period of time. Yeah, I was very amazed. And I have a really interesting episode because my husband and I were engaged with some Marae, so popiri, yeah, one stage. And they asked my husband to sing a song, and he actually sung that one. And all of a sudden, all those Māori senior ladies were in tears because they thought it was so beautiful and emotional. So I had really experienced, yeah, interesting experience.
How lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Speak Up Kōrerotia. You're with Sally Carlton, Anya, Jawad, Jin and Una, and we're talking about bio and multilingualism in New Zealand. We've been speaking a little bit about the benefits, the cognitive, developmental, personal, all sorts of different benefits that can come from speaking multiple languages. And I just thought it might be nice to touch on some of the pushback that we might get, potentially from the children of migrants. Una, you mentioned that it's different migrants speaking their own language or their children speaking that language. Is there any worry from the parents, those sorts of things?
Yeah, just to start, is when we're talking about the learning the language, where we should go? In New Zealand, in Christchurch. And I just want to say the community schools, they're playing a very important role in supporting the community with teaching the language. Many of our schools, they actually exist for 4 years, and some people from the our own community doesn't know they exist. For example, regarding to the benefit of languages. Some kids from our community, they can be fluent in 3 languages, no problem. And it's very high level, actually, Russian, some language, and English, of course. What is specific about our community? Because many of us, they came from the former Soviet Union. We had 15 different countries and different republics in different languages. And it's amazing, in New Zealand, all those people, they because the Russian language was the common language, they bringing kids to our school to share our culture, and I think it's very precious, and we're very proud of this.
Anna, you mentioned at the beginning that you'd done some research on the number of community language schools in Christchurch.
Yes.
How many have we got, and what are those languages? You don't have to list them all if you can't remember.
Yes, around 25.
Goodness,
different
that's a
schools,
lot, isn't it?
But it was very important to see, you know, we can organize a school, but how they operate, who is the teachers? Because some people, they can be native speakers. Some of them, they have qualifications, you know, as a teachers. But there are some very important things. First of all, all of our teachers, they are in New Zealand. We have to know the way how to teachers teach in New Zealand. Maybe people have a very high qualification back to their own country, but, you know, it's not... we have in New Zealand different approach. For example, in our school, I can come and touch kids and hug them and kiss them. Some things, you know, they are not very common in New Zealand. We have to know the rules. And also, that's why I think it's very important working together with the university and other organizations to create the program. So we can offer the teachers some courses. They can have a qualification for a community language teachers. And in this case, Australia has an amazing experience for many years. The first school in Australia was established in 1839, something like that. So they have a big experience. And very important, I think, all community schools, they're working under umbrella of Ministry of Education. It didn't happen in New Zealand so far, but I think it's also very important.
So you're talking professional development for
absolutely
teachers?
Absolutely, professional development.
It's a whole other conversation, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because speaking a language doesn't necessarily guarantee you can teach it.
Absolutely. Mm.
Interesting. Any feedback on that line of thinking?
Yeah, I've been delighted, and as a number of my students have been delighted as well to go along to these sessions that Anna and her colleagues have been organising for the community language teachers and support them in some way. It's been really interesting to meet these dedicated teachers and how very keen they are to develop their pedagogy. So that's been wonderful as an experience.
And also them, I would imagine almost all of them probably doing voluntarily.
Certainly some of them, yes. And as Anna says, a lot of the problem then is with traditional ways of teaching, perhaps that are quite different from the ways that the children are being taught in New Zealand schools. You do have cases then when the children might not want to go to the community language school. Whether or not they do that, it's very, very common that children will begin to answer their parents in English, the majority language. That is an almost universal phenomenon. And there are different ways to deal with that, and there are different strategies to deal with that. And that's one of the things that we have a little lecture on, with some tips on that on our website. But really, I mean, my personal strategy, which I had the privilege of being in Europe, so it wasn't that far to reach the language community, which, as you said, New Zealand it is. I just took that child, left their Swedish daddy and their Swedish friends at home, and we went to Ireland for a week or two to get them out of the majority language context and immerse them in the minority language. And that was a very good strategy, and that worked for us. But it's not that easy for everybody.
This ties into another point. The Russian community, the Farsi-speaking community, the Korean community are relatively large in Christchurch, relatively speaking. If you're coming from, for example, those little villages you were talking about before, in very remote Afghanistan, yep, where very few people speak that language, I imagine that must be even harder. You haven't got, for example, the community schools, the community full stop around those children to give them socialization opportunities. Any thoughts on that? That's sort of even one step further in terms of difficulty.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with that. In the Middle East in general and Afghanistan in specific, there are lots of those small, maybe a little bit, not even a village, maybe a city speaking just one language, which the rest of the country don't speak. But they have found ways of finding a common language in the country. Like as Anna said, Russian has become the common language for all the previous Soviet Union republics. Then, for example, in Afghanistan, they have found, for example, Farsi to communicate with the rest of the... So for them, it's even harder. First, because if they come here, in Afghanistan, they had to learn Farsi. Everything was based on Farsi. Schooling and TVs and radio, most of them in Farsi. So they had to learn, and their language was spoken only in their home. But now, if they come to New Zealand, although the numbers are not a lot, because they were not a lot in Afghanistan as well, so they're struggling. There is no community language for their language. The common language back in home was Farsi, so they have to stick with Farsi because they want to mingle with the rest of the Afghan migrants here. So yeah, it could be linking it back to your previous question, it could be a pushback from children because it's three steps. First, at home they're speaking probably a language, and I see this more from some of my Indian friends who have more local languages, and they have probably a Hindi language spoken in the whole country. So they have to first learn their own, which they don't find any community language, and then the bigger language, which still we're struggling in Christchurch, for example, as you said, that they're not really supported. They're all voluntary work, and it can be a lot of pushback from children that not really willing to go to those community language schools to learn that. Adding to that problem is that most of us are not professional teachers and probably not qualified. Probably Anna knows this community language more than me and knows how those schools are run. So, yeah, I totally agree with you.
One great opportunity that there is nowadays that I didn't have when I was raising my children, and perhaps you didn't have as much either, is that now we have the web, we have a lot of digitally available material, children's programs, movies, music, audiobooks, all of these things are available, even in relatively small languages, which is a huge resource.
Mm.
It just can turn things around. Also, using technology, using perhaps an iPad, a young child even can sit and chat with their grandparents in another country. They can take the iPad, put it into the Lego pit and build some Lego with Granda. That's fully possible. It just wasn't before. So there's every possibility to get some more access. The diaspora has become digital.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with Una, because I believe language is related to culture and their identity. So it is very important for children to speak their parents or heritage or community language somehow. So parents need to put more efforts to make children to speak their heritage language at home. But some minority language communities, they are not big enough to facilitate all those facilities for these children. But anyway, speaking their heritage language at home is the primary source for those children to learn their heritage language. So I think speaking community language, heritage language, whatever language at home is very crucial.
Yes.
It also, I'm sorry. I just want to mention, we're talking about the motivation, how we can motivate. Without motivation, we can't say the child, you must learn the language. It doesn't work. That's, I think, university doing amazing job to educate parents. Mm-hmm. Just telling them, look, you have such an important task in your life to pass your language to your children. And I was amazed how many parents, young parents, attended the seminars at the university for parents.
Anya, you touched on the idea of forcing or obliging children to do it, and I guess this is a nice segue into an article I read just on the weekend in which Una was interviewed about the proposal to have compulsory te reo classes in New Zealand and this idea of making it obligatory for students to learn a language. Una, I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on obliging students to learn a language.
Well, yeah, also even in the home situation, if you're going to make it meaningful for a young person to learn a language, to speak a language, they have to have a need for it. And that's at home as well as in school. So if te reo is going to become compulsory in school, then there becomes a need for it. And that's a reason, I mean, that the same kind of need that there is to learn maths or English or geography, that it's part of their education. They need to get their qualifications. They need to get a job. Depending on how it's done, you might require a level of te reo to enter university. Previously, of course, New Zealand had a system where you needed to have a qualification in a foreign language to enter university. That's gone, and that's really affected the number of people studying languages.
How long ago was that?
Before my time.
Yeah, I've never heard of it. I just have one final question for this segment, which is, we've been speaking about language being so tied to culture and identity, and children and parents and sort of this intergenerational issues around languages. And I just wondered if you have noticed in your experience if children engaging more with English than with the parents' language is having any cultural ramifications in the family. I'm thinking particularly around parental authority being challenged, those sorts of things.
Yes, I can share with my personal experience. I have two children, but my older son made a strong statement once saying that, Mom, you should speak English because we live here in New Zealand. Don't speak Korean at home because it's not good for you either. So I was really concerned about the situation. And then what happened was, that was when he was early teens, but now he's over 20s now. And his identity has changed since then because he was more into, how can I say, Kiwi-centered at that period of time. But as he grew up, he realized that even though he feels his Kiwi, his friends or, you know, other people see him as Asian. So that affect his self-identity development. So now he's more into Korean now. So that made him to learn more Korean language, and he eats more Korean food since then. So now he's Korean Kiwi.
Interesting, isn't it?
Mm.
Any other personal experiences?
Yeah, the matter of children will often oppose the use of the language, the minority language at home, and just as your son did, Jin, say, don't speak that language to me, or I'm a Kiwi, I don't want to know about that stuff. That's old grandma talk, I've heard somebody saying in an interview. But really, I mean, we don't let children decide important things in general. We don't let them to decide whether to walk on the footpath or on the road. We don't let them to decide whether to wear a hat if it's cold or not. We make decisions for the children, and especially things that the children really can't see the consequences of. And I mean, deciding not to speak the minority language, the home language at home, it has catastrophic consequences, because once the parents stop talking it, then it's gone from the family.
Exactly. So even though he made that strong statement, I just kept speaking Korean to him, and now he's grateful. And some of child participants from my study said that now they regret if they feel they are not very fluent bilingual, like balanced mm-hmm. bilingual. So now they blame their parents, mm-hmm. not push them to learn Korean language.
And we've never met anyone who regrets having been obliged to learn their heritage language.
Probably we need to talk about this more and more, promote bilingualism. And as far as I know, according to our statistics, all our students, they are very successful when they can speak two or three languages. Mm-hmm. So in their career, everywhere. Yeah, so that's important.
Okay, well, we're going to have our final song break now. Uno, I've gone with, you suggested a few, but I've gone with Ida Sommarvisa. A Swedish song?
It's a Swedish song. It's actually a song from the movie version of Emilie Lönneberga, which is one of Astrid Lindgren's stories. And this is a song that's sung at every end of school year and every summer in Sweden. It's quite nostalgic for any Swedes listening.
Ska inte tro det blir sommar ifall inte någon sätter fart på sommaren och gör lite somrigt, då kommer blommorna snart. Jag gör så att blommorna blommar, jag gör hela kohagen grön, och nu så har sommaren kommit, för jag har just tagit bort snön.
Listening to Speak Up Korerochi here on Plains FM 96.9. We're with guests and we're thinking about bi and multilingualism in New Zealand. And just to round up this conversation, we're going to think about, how do you begin? Should you just start talking to a child in their first language? And how does it change as that child gets older and starts to enter the English language society?
I would like to say very strongly, please speak your language to your child from the very beginning, before they're born.
I agree with Una, because then children feel the language is become part of their body. So that's what some child participants said. They don't really think about two languages. It works just like that in their brain, so it can become part of themselves.
That's a nice comment about, we talk about identity, but really it being kind of physically embodied as well. That's really cool.
Thank you.
And how about as a child gets older and they might have been exposed to their parents' language for the first, say, 2 or 3 years of their life, and then maybe they start at preschool or kindergarten, and they start getting exposure to English as they meet playmates and teachers, and then presumably that gets more and more as they start to spend more time at school. How does that affect the child's linguistic development?
I think children can speak many languages. In our experience, we have a sort of competition in Russian language, and some kids, 4-year-old, 5-year-old, they can speak 5-6 languages, not like answer a couple of questions, but they are in some way they can read, they can even write. So there are no limitations, and my advice, don't be afraid of teach your child another language. It's for benefit for sure.
We've been talking about it's obviously very beneficial, but how can we start to get the word out there? There's obviously a dearth of or lack of information.
Yeah, I like to talk about an information desert. We actually found out by talking to midwives and to doctors and to nurses and even to speech and language therapists that they don't have a lot of information in their education. They don't have brochures ready to give out. You'd think they would to families who are expecting or have a young child. Plunkett nurses, for example, they don't have anything to give. So that's something we've been trying to produce to a certain extent, some material for professionals. But it's difficult. So we've been trying to make our material web-based so that it's accessible even for people who can't come out to our workshops and public lectures.
Are you finding as well that there's any false information out there?
We're finding some misleading information. For example, the Office of Ethnic Affairs had a report in 2013 which ended up by suggesting that migrants should consider speaking English to their children. And in fact, what they really wanted to say was that it's really important that migrants learn English so they can get out to work.
But the message was sent.
Yes, the message was a little muddled. And that's really unfortunate if migrants think that they're doing their children a favour by speaking English, because they're doing them a disservice. Their children will not thank them when they're older if they haven't given them the language. And that's even if it's a very small language.
It's a shame, because there are so many information and experienced people who can share knowledge and teach kids, and people don't use them. Just let's come to the community schools, and I think another step, the community schools should go to the schools to promote the language, beauty of the language. You know?
Another thing is, Anna, you talk about teaching the language, and of course that's what the community language schools do. Sometimes parents come up to us and say, but I'm not a good teacher, I can't give my child my language. And parents don't actually teach children their language. They just use the language with the children. And that's how we learn our first languages. It's that simple. You don't need to be a teacher.
It comes back to what Jin was saying about it being kind of embodied, doesn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the most natural thing in the world to talk to a child. You just do it in your own language. You don't need to think about grammatical rules. In fact, you shouldn't.
And by doing that, children learn their parents' cultural factors and beliefs and values.
Yeah, so important, particularly when they're isolated from it being here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just to finish off, on the 21st of February, it's Mother Language Day, and we're sort of holding this conversation in honour of that event. And Anya, you're involved in an event at Hagley Community College this coming Saturday, the 18th of February, which is all about encouraging people to speak multiple languages. So if you want to give just a little bit of a plug, that would be great.
Yes, please come and share the beauty of your language. We want to listen to your language. And please read the poetry, or just come and listen to others. Share with us, you know, everything what you want to share is your language.
Hopefully this sort of event as well, and the seminars that the university are holding, might be ways of getting people more engaged and more informed about what's going on.
Mm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to finish off, I wondered if any of you have a saying or a quote in your own languages that tie in with this conversation we've been having today around the importance of language, identity, culture. I thought that might be a really beautiful way of finishing off.
Maybe I can start. I'm not too sure whether this is Korean saying or maybe someone from Western culture, but it's quite common to say that language is a mirror of yourself.
And in Korean?
언어는 자기 자신의 모습이다.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Anyone in Farsi?
Well, I had one in mind which it was a bit radical, so I decided not to. Because it doesn't really talk about keeping your identity. It's basically disregarding or negating, following other culture without considering your own culture. So it's kind of a... the topic was more about keeping your own identity rather than, you know, following other cultures. So that's why I decided.
It sounds quite pertinent for migrants, though, I would imagine. Yep. You know, you're being surrounded by somebody else's culture, so trying to stay true to your own values and your own culture, as well as embracing the new culture.
Yeah. So...
Yes, I have my favorite. Can't remember it belonged to someone, but in Russian, it «Ты столько раз человек, сколько языков ты знаешь». So you, so many times you are human being, it depends how many languages do you know.
Oh, perfect. Anything from Ireland? Sweden?
Unfortunately, because of, for a number of historical reasons, I don't actually speak Irish. But I can take something from Sweden, which is my second language as a migrant. I lived 30 years there. And I can say, små grytor har också öron. And literally it means that small pots also have handles, or ears is the word in Swedish for it. So small pots have ears as well. So small children also have ears. So don't forget that the children hear what you say. And, of course, that's used to don't say anything that you shouldn't say that's inappropriate. But I'd like to turn it around and say, please speak to your children because they're listening.
Well, that seems like the ideal way to finish up this conversation then. So I'd like to say thank you all so much for coming in. It's been a really, really interesting conversation. And I hope that this can hopefully generate a bit more thinking, a bit more debate around the importance of speaking multiple languages in a society that's very monolingual.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.